Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints. And we have a show today that is jam-packed. It's going to be fantastic. But let me preface it by saying that this show is being monitored and recorded by Blog Talk for quality assurance to make sure that only the right people call in. The show will be made public after the show is over, and any comments that you want to make, I hope they are positive, because if they're not, I will delete them. And on that note,
good.
I'm one person that you don't want to start with me. It's not a good thing. So we have the author of New York Times author Wendy Corsi Stubb of Bone White. And this is absolutely a fantastic book that everybody wants to read. In the year since former NYPD Detective Sullivan Leary solved the historic Sleeping Beauty murders, she, like the village itself, has made a fresh start, but someone has unearthed blood-drenched secrets in a disembodied skull. Cool. And is hacking away at the Mundy family tree, branch by branch. That was really, like, the first scene in the book got me. So that was the first question. When you started this book, you started off with a hanging in the past of two people that were said to murder someone. How did watching the deaths impact on the children? That was like, oh, my God.
Okay, so this happened in 1667, I think, 1666. So that at that time, these were colonists who resorted to survivalist cannibalism to feed their family through this winter in this Hudson Valley colony that I made up. It's a fictional place. It's on the Hudson River. Mm-hmm. So these things really happened, and the whole thing was inspired by something I read in Smithsonian Magazine about Jamestown Colony and how that had happened there. So in the book, the couple survives with their three children. Everybody else in the colony has perished from starvation when the reinforcements come in the spring. And so this is, you know, these are Puritan times, and they just assume, you know, they're horrified. They hang the couple. They convict them. It's immediate, you know, and that's how the justice system works back then. So this couple was hung in the town, in the colony square, sort of, from this tree in front of their young children, who were then orphaned. It impacted them. They couldn't go anywhere else. I mean, if you think about it, the oldest son was 13. Mm-hmm. They were surrounded now by people who thought their parents were murderers, who knew they had eaten human flesh to survive, and they couldn't leave. You know, surrounded by wilderness, wild animals, they were stranded there. So they became very resourceful and survived and had to stay. And years later, they redeemed the family name, and the town was named after their descendants. It's called Mundy's Landing. So these are the Mundy orphans. It's the Mundy family.
Yeah, it was interesting, I'll tell you, and scary. I'm saying, oh, my God, another book to give me nightmares. It was really good, though. And,
Thank you.
How did the title come into play as we see the town of Mundy's Landing and in the past and the present with the white bones of the dead? And what did they say? They will never lie. Oh, that is so cool. That was just in bold letters. They even wrote it in my review when you see it later. I put that in bold letters. I go, we shall never tell.
Yeah, we shall never tell. I mean, that's how that phrase just came to me. You know, that's pretty provocative. I write psychological suspense, so I always... You know, there are always secrets, and they sort of come from a place of you never really know what's going on, you know, behind closed doors, and you never know what's going on in someone's head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could be really scary stuff. So we shall never tell is a promise that the Mundy's orphans wrote to each other in a letter that's now found centuries later, and it was a promise they made to their dying parents, you know, who had just been executed. They said, we shall never tell. So obviously there's more to the story than anyone ever knew. And now, you know, in the present day, this descendant has discovered a letter from the sister to the brother, and she sets out to find out the truth behind it. She comes to Mundy's Landing and tries to figure out what really happened. Oh, and the bone, you asked me about the title, so I have to say, Bone White refers to a skull that has been unearthed at the site of the colony. It was unearthed by archaeologists, and it shows signs of not just of cannibalism, but whoever it was a young girl, she died of a blunt force trauma to the skull. So did she fall and hurt herself during that winter when everybody was starving, or did somebody murder her? You know, that's the secret. That's what lies at the heart of the book, in the past anyway.
In the past anyway. You don't want to know the past, present, well.
Right.
So we meet Emerson Monday. She's interesting. And she travels to her ancestral hometown to trace her past. So she created a present for herself. What would her bio be? Who did she say she was?
So she's always been a history buff. But she never knew about her own history. When she was a little girl, her mom left. You know, she was raised by a single dad, and he took care of her. The mother walked out, so she never knew whatever happened to her mother, who she was. The father destroyed every picture of her, and it was just the two of them all of her life. And now she's in her 30s, and he's passed away. So she's curious about her own past. She is a history buff. She used to ask her father if they were related to the famous Mundy's Landing orphans that she used to read about in her history books, and he always said no. So now she's discovered that indeed there is a connection, a family connection. She's a teacher. She teaches history. And she lives in San Francisco. She's built a life for herself away from her dad, but she is a devoted daughter and comes back and takes care of him. They are all they have in the world. This father and daughter have only each other. So now she's alone. She's orphaned and trying to find out, you know, the truth. So.
Well, she's going out with this guy. And I didn't really like him, to be very honest. I didn't really like him.
I don't think she really likes him either.
No, I mean, seriously, anybody that dates somebody that has to know where you are every 5 minutes gets me nervous, too.
Right.
Who is Roy, and why does he insist on tracking her? I mean, he almost, like, put a GPS in her. And he had to know where she was every minute. Why is that?
Okay, so in my books, like I said, people are never who they really seem to be, or sometimes they are, but you just don't know. So Roy, is he a clingy boyfriend, or is he, you know, a stalker, like boyfriend? You know, there's some ambiguity there. He is really concerned about her, or so he says. And she feels stifled by this. You know, here's a person who's been alone and is lonely, and she has somebody who wants to be with her every second. But, you know, that should tell you something, that she is pulling away a little bit from this guy. So,
I don't blame her.
Or is she?
Or is she?
Or is he a loving boyfriend who's very concerned because she has, you know, ventured, you know, suddenly she's dropped everything and gone cross country. And, you know, he's like, what's going on? Where are you? So I sort of wanted to walk a fine line there. And you can decide for yourself as you read the book, and all becomes clear in the end. Certainly.
We won't tell them how. So you have a character that recurs, right? Detective Sullivan Leary.
Yeah.
She solved the Sleeping Beauty murders in the past, but someone seems to want to unearth them in the present. So Death comes forward as she tries to uncover who might be responsible for the death by someone calling themselves the Hangman in the past and in the present. So how do they link together? That was scary, let me tell you.
So the Sleeping Beauty murders, Mundy's Landing is on the map for two different historical creepy things that had happened. And this is the third book in a trilogy about Mundy's Landing. It's a standalone. Bone White is a standalone. You know, it's complete. But if you want to know what happened with the Sleeping Beauty murders, that is the book right before this. That's Blue Moon. And in that book, you have a copycat killer who is recreating the unsolved murders of the summer of 1916. And those murders were, this is the creepiest thing I could imagine. There are families that wake up on beautiful warm summer mornings to find a dead stranger, a young woman, tucked into the guest room bed. in their homes. So that happened 100 years ago in Mundy's Landing, and now 100 years later, it's a copycat killer, and Sully finds her way to Mundy's Landing. She's in all three of these books. The first book was Blood Red, but she popped up as a walk-on character in my book, The Black Widow, a few years back. She and her partner, mm-hmm. Stockton Barnes, are missing persons detectives in New York when we first meet them. And she was one of those characters that, you know, I felt like she needs to come back. I really like her. She resonated with me and with the readers. So suddenly, you know, four books later, here's Sully again, you know.
No, she's a good character. She's a good character.
Thank you.
But Emerson wants to find out about something. So tell us about, I love this character, Aurora, and her commitment to the historical society. And why does everyone think she's senile? And why do so many classes of children and teachers come to her for the tours? I mean, my mother had Alzheimer's, and let me tell you, Aurora was definitely, I don't know why they think she's senile. I mean, I've dealt with the illness, and even my mother wasn't that bad, but seriously.
Yeah.
So why does everybody think that she's so disturbed because she's so old?
She's okay. So, Aura, her real name is Aurora, and she was named after the Sleeping Beauty. so her family, her father was a history professor years and years and years ago, and her great aunt was the curator of the Mundy's Landing Historical Society. And Aura took over when her aunt died in the 40s. Their business, she always says, you know, their family business is history. She is obsessed with the local history, and it's almost as if, I mean, she's a spinster, it's almost as if she's married to the village of Mundy's Landing. Mm-hmm. She's devoted her whole life to this village and to the past. So Aura conceived, when Mundy's Landing sort of fell upon hard times in the 60s and 70s, like a lot of upstate towns, you know, and businesses were shuttered on Main Street, and she came up with this idea to bring tourism to Mundy's Landing. She invited people from across the country or around the world, really, to come and attempt to solve the unsolved Sleeping Beauty murders of 1916. So every year, this has gotten more and more attention. She offers a big reward. The society moves to a big mansion, you know, one of the historic mansions in the Heights, and this is her livelihood. This is her whole life. And all of a sudden, in the Sleeping Beauty, on the centennial year, the murders are solved. There's a copycat killer. At the end of Blue Moon, the murders are solved. And she realizes, my life is kind of empty. You know, so how strange, right, that this old woman who can just now be peaceful and just sort of live out her days, she suddenly needs to know about the skull that she inherited from her great aunt, the one that was dug up at the site. Now she wants to solve that first mystery, and she feels as though she can't rest in peace until she knows what really happened with the Mundys. So that's where this book opens, and if you think about it, that seems a little eccentric. Mm-hmm. But when we go into Aura's head, you know, we can, again, there's a little ambiguity. You can make up your own mind. Does she have all her marbles? Is she just a woman who deeply cares? Or is she a little bit batty? You know, this is an obsession for her. So I think that
I just realized, I realized why I know the character, because I did review Blue Moon. It's on my site.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
I did. And yeah. When Partners in Crime does something, they don't let me get away without doing it.
So there you go.
Seriously, I'm going to post this right now. As a matter of fact,
you can link it.
It's funny because
yeah.
I have the excerpt from the book and everything, and I'm saying,
oh my gosh,
I know
this
book, and I'm saying, just hit there. I just posted it, so everybody could read my post on Blue Moon, which of course was fantastic, as usual.
Oh, thank you. You're awesome. Thanks so much.
I knew the character. I don't forget. So she enlists the help of a woman named Savannah, who was another good character, to uncover the name and the history of the skull that she has from the past when James and Elizabeth were hanged. So this bothers her because that's kind of an unusual gift to get,
yes.
to inherit.
the skull.
That was really how her family.
Yeah. I mean, they are, like I said, Papa, her father, was a history professor. Her aunt was the curator. And those are the only two people who raised her. She has, kind of has a lot in common with Emerson, if you think about it. But so she gets this skull. She also has a lot of other treasures in a secret drawer in the attic of the Historical Society. You know, her aunt was a little bit maybe eccentric too, and helped herself to artifacts that she thought, you know, like she was in the library once, great Aunt Etta, and she found a first edition that was just out in the general circulation, and she helped herself to it because she said, you know, I will cherish this and treat it right. So that's kind of how their family operates. So yeah, Aura gets the skull, and she's, you know, she has no qualms about finding out the truth. So she goes to the college where her father used to teach, and she finds this young girl, Savannah. She's actually in her 20s, and she's been awarded a grant. She's very smart. And she is an anthropologist, a forensic anthropologist. And she, Aura thinks that she will need the money, that Aura can pay her, and that she will give the answers without anyone in town knowing what, you know, what Aura's up to, because she doesn't want anybody to realize that this is necessarily going on. She's still skittish, too, because she had a run-in with the Sleeping Beauty copycat killer. So she's a little bit, again, you know, is she traumatized? Is this post-traumatic stress, or is she truly senile? You know, ambiguity.
She's one of my good characters. So when Savannah begins to work for her, she meets Brayden. So who is he in relation to the Mondays, and why does he seem so interested in her at first, anyway?
This goes back to the first book in this trilogy was called Blood Red, and Rowan Mundy is a local school teacher. Her oldest son's name is Brayden. He is, you know, this brilliant kid. He just graduated from college from Dartmouth. You know, he's an Ivy League kid, has everything going for him. He's having trouble, and he is now back living with his parents and sort of drifting around town and trying to figure out what he wants to do next. So he comes in contact with Savannah. And I don't want to give away too much about their connection, but he also has an interest. He's a Mundy, you know, he is a Mundy. This is his family that was executed all those centuries ago. So he kind of has a stake in things. And she also looks at him and says, you know, he's kind of the golden boy. Savannah's, there's a theme that runs through, certainly through Bone White, of, you know, family and identity and hard times and people sort of searching for a place to belong and searching for the perfect home and family and town. And Mundy's landing on the surface seems to be that for a lot of people. And here's this kid, Brayden, who fits in there. He belongs there. He is a Mundy, and yet he's restless and unhappy. So there's a lot going on there. That's why we kind of don't know what's going on with him necessarily right away.
Well, then we have an odd relationship that comes about. We meet Emerson, and then she connects with Sully and Rowan, who is a Monday. So why do they like her right away? And
okay.
I'm not going to ask the second part of the question because I crossed it out.
A little spoiler.
I crossed out the next two people. You're not going to know anything. So tell her, how come Sully liked her right away and connected her?
Yeah.
And how come she introduced her to Rowan?
Well, so Rowan, when we meet Rowan, Rowan's one of those people who's very open and welcoming and self-deprecating. She's kind of one of those people who just embraces strangers and stray animals. You know, she has stray kittens living on her steps, and she has this crazy dog, and she took in her nephew. You know, she is one of those people who just is drawn to people in need, and we kind of get that sense, I think. If you read Blood Red, too, you would sort of get that right away, but Rowan's had a troubled life, too, so she's drawn to people who have had difficulties. So she is a Mundy. She's married. She's not a Mundy by blood, but she's married to Jake Mundy, who is descended also from those early Mondays. So she's the person that Sully says, you know, I can put you in touch. When Sully meets Emerson, she says, I can put you in touch with your ancestral family. You know, these are your cousins, long lost family. So that's why Emerson says, of course, I would love to meet, you know, his long lost cousin. And that's the thing about Monday's Landing and the people in it. It's a small town. It's a really friendly, charming, picture-perfect small town on the surface. So people are welcoming. You know, people are, they know each other. We have peripheral characters who come and go through all three books. Mm. I kind of wanted to capture that because I come from a similar town in upstate New York, and now I live in a town that's very much that way. So just a town where, you know, people aren't, they're pretty quick to embrace newcomers, I would say. So, and that's why those women, you know, that's why, and Sully is a newcomer, you know, so she just moved there to start over. She's left her job in NYPD and she's here. And so she wants to make friends. She's a little bit cut off from her old life and is just sort of looking for friends. And Emerson is a young single woman to whom she can relate. That's a really long answer for a
that's
really
okay.
simple question.
I crushed out the second two questions, so that's okay. We had time for that one. So
okay.
My question is that, now, Emerson is staying at this hotel, and she meets Nancy. Well, she doesn't trust her because she thinks that she's going to snoop. Why is that? And
so
that is so cool.
Nancy is one of those people who – you know, you meet her, you know, it's just, you go into a store and someone's asking a lot of questions and they're just very chatty.
Yeah.
So that's fine. Like, I'm very chatty. That doesn't bother me. My husband's a person who's very private. So his guard would immediately go up upon meeting someone who asks a lot of questions. So that's kind of where I was going when you first meet her. Emerson is a really private person. And to her, someone who's saying, oh, I looked you up on the internet, and I know this, this, and this, and we've upgraded you to the suite because we know you're a Mundy. You know, her guard goes up. She lives in Berkeley, you know, in California. She's not used to tiny little towns where everybody knows your business immediately. So I think that that, again, you know, and then you just have to start to wonder, because in my books, everyone kind of becomes a suspect. So is Nancy truly what she appears to be and kind of a local busybody, or is she, you know, is she up to something more, you know, devious, I guess is the word. So I think it's about perception. And when you establish characters and you try to stay true to what you've established, personality types, when you throw them together, you know, one person's perception won't be the same as someone else's. So seeing Nancy through the eyes of Emerson is going to give you a certain view of her.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I'm not going to give away the ending, but they'll never figure it out.
Which is
seriously a good thing. I mean, I loved the part that I loved that I didn't include questions. I loved the journals from before, from 1676. I loved, you know, letters between Priscilla and Jeremiah. And that helped to get to know them better and helped to understand what they were going through. So before we continue, how come you included that? That was interesting. It made the book I was able to understand them and meet them and say, oh, these poor kids, they were going, and then poor Priscilla wanted to get married, and her brother said, uh-uh.
Right, exactly. And that was also a sign of the time. So you're flashing back to the 17th century here when things were very different. And I thought, I don't want to do flashbacks in any of these three books. They were all, this trilogy was about the past in so many ways, but flashbacks can feel lazy. So with the first book, we did newspaper articles that showed Mundy's Landing in the past. In Blood Red, I did all these newspaper articles. In the second book, I did journals of the Sleeping Beauty killer in the past and in the present. And in this book, I said to my editor, you know, I need to figure out sort of a device to show what happened without flashing back and forth in time. I did include that prologue in the beginning because I will tell you, I wrote that prologue before I even sold the series, and I meant that to be the opening of the first book. And my editor said, this belongs in book three. Like, this is something that we need to save for Bone White. So that was the only flashback in all of this. And I just felt like these, in this book, the letters felt organic, especially because you're talking about a letter that says we shall never tell. Well, what led up to that letter and what came after? You know, and the only way to piece things together when people are long dead is to either hear them in their voices or find some kind of evidence. And we're certainly not going to, you know, I mean, it's just things were different. You, it's a challenge to solve a crime in the past, and that's what I learned with this whole trilogy. So that was one way for me to tell the reader, and you know, we don't know if these characters ever saw all of the letters, but at least the crime is solved, and you know the what and the why.
Well, she could point, poor Priscilla goes through, she meets this wonderful guy, and then poor Nathaniel, oh gosh, I feel so bad.
I know. In the past, right? And then you find out what. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give anything away again, but I have to say, yeah, to me, things were so different back then, and women were treated so differently back then, obviously.
Yeah.
So I think I really tried to capture that, the restrictions of the time and place,
mm-hmm.
you know. That was part of the fascination for me in creating these characters in the past.
Yeah, well, they it comes out as that, let me tell you, and I don't think I'd want to live back then.
No, I know, right?
Me who doesn't take, I don't take orders very well, no. So,
right, no,
when,
me either.
So, no, I mean, yeah, my husband gets annoyed, too, because I ask a lot of questions, and then if I'm not sure, I'll call back and ask another one, and he'll
mm-hmm.
go like, why are you doing that? I said, because I am entitled to know what I need to know so that
exactly.
I don't fall into a deep hole. Yeah, they don't get it.
I mean,
no matter who it is, if I want to know something, like I did about an hour ago, I said, you know, I want to understand that. And if
you
don't understand it, then someone else will. I don't care.
Right. I want to be heard. Let me be heard, you know, and let me hear.
Trust me.
Yeah.
They don't care, but I don't, you know, they get annoyed,
yeah.
but I don't care. So when Sully's old partner, Barnes, I like this guy too, comes to town, why is he there? And how come he doesn't want anybody to know he's there?
Okay, so this is Stockton. His name is Stockton Barnes, and he is her detective partner from the NYPD Missing Persons. And I'm not going to tell you why he is.
No.
I'm not going to tell you the whole story because it comes out at the end that there's a lot more to his past than even Sully knew. Sully and Barnes worked together for years and years and years. You know, they were together in a car, you know, just sort of, so they didn't just talk about their cases. They talked about each other's pasts. And Barnes, she's kind of his one confidant, but there is a little bit of spark between them. There always has been. They seem like opposites. But Barnes, you know, he keeps to himself. And so now that Sully's out of his life, he didn't want her to move away. And he's kind of a ladies' man, you know. He's done his own thing ever since she left a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, he shows up haggard and, you know, gaunt. There's something clearly wrong. And he says, I had to come to you. Like, I had to come here. You know, he's hiding. He's hiding from someone. And we're going to find out more about this in a future book. But we do know that has a lot to do with something that he never told Sully. So now she has to think, can I trust him, this man that I always, you know, I would have trusted him with my life. Now he's been lying to me about, you know, his past for all these years. How do I trust him now? Is he, you know, who is he really? So there's a lot that comes up between them. It's sort of a side plot in this book, but I feel like it's intrinsic to who she is. And the relationship between them takes a little bit of a turn here, too, in a couple of different ways. So I'm going to revisit.
Well, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. You were interviewed by interviewer David English about a year ago. And
yeah.
He's on Facebook.
Yeah.
And he wants to know, do you still write only one draft?
Oh, that's a really good question. And tell David English I said hello. I do write one draft most of the time. I would say one draft of my own. I don't get to the end and then go back and write a different kind of story. I give it to my editor and then rewrite from her notes or from his notes. You know, this isn't. I have another series that I work on for Crooked Lane, and I just rewrote that book according to the editor's notes, and it did change significantly. But my own work, I am not one of those people who can work from an outline, you know, create one and work from one, and I so wish that I were. It's challenging not to. So I kind of write the story. I revise constantly as I'm writing every day. I'm rewriting. But when I get to the end, that is the end, and it goes to my editor. So, yeah.
I am answering him.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I'm mentoring him at the same time. Yeah. And I'm going to answer this one. Yeah, this is a trilogy, yes.
Does she still write trilogies?
Yes. Yeah, that's a stand, yeah. So tell us about Sully and her childhood, and how come she was closer with her grandfather, with her grandparents, than her parents?
Well, Sully was born into a family, and you know, I've gotten to know her over four books now, and different pieces of her life keep coming. You know, I feel like she really exists in my mind anyway, and that she keeps sort of stepping back and revealing a little more to me. So her family, she was born into a family of NYPD, you know, going back 100 years. And that's something that is, you know, I live in the New York suburbs. I know some police officers, and you know, sometimes that is sort of like a family business where, you know, fathers and sons and brothers are all, you know, part of that. So she comes into a family like that. Her parents, she's an only child. Her parents are both police officers. Their families are. But they're busy, obviously, and they're working nights. And so she spends a lot of time with her grandparents. Her grandfather's a retired cop, Big Red, and he's an interesting guy. I'm not sure. We might need to revisit him down the road, too. But they kind of babysit her, I guess, in a sense. And, you know, he's a guy who, you know, he teaches, they play cards for pennies or whatever. And the grandmother's very old-fashioned and doesn't want him to do that. And Big Red's an irreverent guy. He's got a fun streak. He's a lively kind of a guy. And she's a lot like him. So she fondly remembers her grandfather. And in the past, you know, they played not just cards, but they used to play hangman. This guy was very literary and literate. He read a lot, and he loved words and language. And so they used to play hangman, the hangman game. So that certainly comes into play in this book.
I love to play hangman.
We used to play it. That came to me because we always played it with our kids. I have two boys. And when we would go to a restaurant, you know, like a diner or whatever, when they were little, we would play hangman on the paper placemat to keep them busy if the food took a long time. So my sister and I used to play
hangman together, and I love when I used to win.
me too.
And I love picking words that no one would know how to spell. Those are the most fun words. Words that no one ever heard of. And she would say, "Where did you come up with that?" I said, "Did you forget I'm smart?"
Right, and look it up in the dictionary. It's real.
I would have a list in my head, and I'd say, well, this is not going to get this. So tell us about, you included the letters of Priscilla, and you have, why did you include the letters from Horace and Aurora? That was interesting, too.
Because I was trying to show, so Horace and Aurora, so Horace is Emerson Mundy's ancestor, about in the 1800s, you know, he had a really difficult life, and she's descended from him, and we kind of need to know, you know, there are secrets there, too. This family has had secrets and some tragedies going all the way back for these centuries, and I wanted to show what kind of people these are. They're very resilient, you know, they managed to, these orphans managed to overcome being the pariahs of the town and then have it named after them. So through the years, Horace Mundy was a financier and had a brother named Oswald, who was sort of the ne'er-do-well. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to show a little bit of their relationship in the 1800s so that you can see it as it is handed down, as some of these character traits are handed down. I think it lends you insight into the characters in the present day. You know, I that's always fascinated me. So yeah, we meet these people through their letters, and we see how their relationships were. Mm-hmm. And we also meet Great Aunt Etta, Aura's great aunt, who tells her certain things about what she would like for the future of the historical society and what she's giving her. You know, that to me, I love that. I love that we get to see that relationship develop, and we sort of get to see that the niece has almost become, in a sense, the aunt. You know, that was her legacy, and she's living it, or is living it, and you understand that through the letters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have an offer for you, and I'm going to email it to you later. David English would like to interview you again.
Oh,
I
absolutely.
I have his email address. I figured you'd say that. And his show is called AOL.com, newsportsweather.com. I didn't think anybody was listening, was watching with Uncombe, and I'm going to say she...
Absolutely.
...accepts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he was. I got interviewed by him, too. That was interesting, let me tell you.
Yeah.
who was Etta Adams? And tell us the importance of the pamphlet that she created.
Okay, so there's a pamphlet that is in the archives at the college, Hadley College, the college just outside of Mundy's Landing, and that's where Aura's father taught history for years. So in the archives there, we have Savannah. She's our forensic anthropologist. She goes to the library and is looking for, you know, if she's going to figure out what happened to the skull, she has to figure out, you know, to whom did the skull belong and what really happened. Was this young woman murdered? What we shall never tell what, you know, it's sort of that, those secrets, some of those secrets are in the archives at the Historical Society. And there's a pamphlet that was written by Etta Abrams on an old-fashioned typewriter, I think early in the 20th century, and it contains clues to the past that, you know, this is one of those things. I actually spent some time in the genealogy department at SUNY Geneseo, where my son is, he's about to graduate, actually, but I had family that was, my great aunt and uncle were born there. I always knew that, you know, my ancestors lived there around the late 1890s, and I went and I did find information there that showed that to me. And in that room, there was so much fascinating information, and they had archived these types of pamphlets, you know, things where people assembled, you know, just even stories that were handed down through the years. Historians would assemble them, and there's one copy, you know, it's typewritten and it's in there. And that was what I was going for with that in this book.
Well, I have one more question that I'm going to ask. And
okay.
He wants to know, who do you consider as writer friends? I just sent his email to Cheryl so that she can put him in touch with you.
Oh, David English? Yeah.
David. Yep. I don't have – I have his English, his email. I have it, and I just sent it to Cheryl. And
okay.
I can give it
thank
to you afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
And,
I
don't have your email. He's on Facebook. That's what I did. I said if anybody wanted to ask questions or something, they could ask him on Facebook, because I wasn't going to worry that somebody asked somebody that I don't want to ask.
Right,
so,
exactly.
He says, who do you consider as writer friends? That's a unique question.
Oh, my gosh. And if I name names, I will be in big trouble. I have to say, you know, interestingly, in this, you know, this is a lonely business. You sit in a room by yourself. You're always alone when you're writing. So when you are let out of your little room where you write and go to a conference, you know, writers are some of the most social people I know. Certainly this industry, my industry, you know, the mystery suspense community thrillers. We're a fun bunch, and we have a couple of conferences every year. We go to BoucherCon, and the Edgars are coming up next week. And actually, Blue Moon is nominated for the Mary Higgins Clark Award next week, so I'm so honored. That's like our water cooler conversation, and I feel like those are my coworkers. And the best part about it is that some of these people are household names. And I was really starstruck, and I still am sometimes when I meet certain people. I was really starstruck to find myself having drinks with them or whatever, you know. So I'm not going to name names, but I will say I have a regular crew, and we have a great time when we see each other, and that most people would recognize their names, and they're certainly on bookshelves around
I know how that feels, because I get invited to the PhilaFest every year. I'm going to be there this year again.
Oh, good. I'll be there, too.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. I get to say hi for real. And I got invited by John Land, who I love more than anything in the world.
Oh, yeah.
He's great.
He's great, yep.
And the first time I went there, I was in total, like, huh?
Because, I know,
you know,
right?
You walk into a room with all of you guys, and then I walked up to Catherine Coulter.
Right.
Asked her for an interview, and she's looking at me. And actually, she agreed to one. She did one.
Oh, that's great.
And she sends me her books. And I was like, oh, my God, my husband's looking at me and says, you have guts. Then, of course, I walked up to Steve Berry, and he actually knew who I am.
Oh, he's a good guy, too, yeah.
And my favorite, of course, I love Daniel Palmer. I think he's
great.
But
yes.
I walked up to R.L. Stein going, could you please sign this? My niece loves you. So he says, I hope I'm – he said, I love to scare people, especially you. It was hilarious. And I go, R.L., just, you know, he's so – he's very
he's
nice.
A good guy. I just wrote a – yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
And he's funny as anything.
He
really
is.
Funny.
He's very dry. I actually have known him for many years, and it was so much fun when my kids were little that because their friends, they and their friends were reading all of his books, and they were so impressed that I actually know him. I just wrote a short story for him for our Mystery Writers of America. We were publishing. It's called Scream and Scream Again. I think is the working title. It's coming next year. But yeah, he is. He's really funny. He's a really good guy, and. Yeah, he's one of those names that when I meet little kids, I'm like, you know what? He's a real person, and I know him, and he's a nice guy. So yeah,
I
and
know,
we're all
it's
real
like
people.
My,
everybody.
I took a picture with him, and my nephew had called me at the Thule Fest, and he said, "Aunt Fran, you know what do you want to tell me?" I go, "Jake, this is a picture for you," and he flipped out because I sent it to him. He says, "No, I'm going to take it to school."
Yep.
He's like, oh, my God. He flipped out. Yep. He's like, oh, my God, my aunt knows R.L. Stein. She didn't care that I know anybody else.
Right. No, I know. He's a rock star, yeah.
So a few
great.
More
that
questions. And he wants to know, what does he want to know? How many books have you written now?
I've written about 90. I published about 90. A few of those I ghost wrote over the years for other authors and for celebrities. So some of them I can't. Yeah, some of them I can't tell you about ever, but I published about, I think it's about 90. I need to figure that out. I keep saying, yeah, a few years ago it was well over 80, so I guess I'm closing in on 90. But I write under other names. I certainly did in the past. I have a pseudonym, Wendy Markham, and that's for women's fiction, and I did 2 dozen books as Wendy Markham. So, yeah, I have always been pretty
prolific. I'm excited that I wrote 13.
Yeah. Well,
I'm excited I wrote 13. I'm writing.
Yeah.
I'm writing the next one.
Good for you.
So I have, before I forget, tomorrow I will be on with James Marshall Smith, Silent Source. And on Monday, if the time allows and the time changes, Steve Berry.
Great.
At 9 o'clock in the morning, The Lost Order. And on the 27th, Dishonored and Forgotten. And it's great. Oh, David just said I should be a co-host with him. That should be interesting. I don't know.
That would be fun.
And May 2nd, I have Stephen Manchester Ashes. And on May 8th, let me tell you, I'm so excited, Brian Freeman Marathon. What happens when you're wrongly accused of killing someone and you're a Muslim and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and your life gets ruined?
Wow.
And on the 9th, this is like mind-boggling, and he asked me for it, the head writer of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer.
Oh, awesome.
It's on May 9th.
Wow, you have quite a lineup there.
Is that not,
tune in.
Yeah, let me tell you something. I get starstruck. I'm like, and I, you know, you walk into the room and I go like, okay, I can walk over to those people. And my husband's like, can you walk? I walked up to Sandra Brown last year and I go like, hi, how are you? And she's okay.
Of course. You have a great job on both ends, you know, the writing and the interviewing.
So when Savannah begins to work with Brayden, she's in a relationship with, who's in a relationship to the Mondays. Why does he seem interested and yet, he disappears. Oh, wait a minute. I asked that before. Yeah. He disappears. How come he disappears out of nowhere?
I think I'm going to keep the answer to that one to myself.
Okay.
Because, well, we know that he disappears. He tells her he had to go for a job interview in Hartford.
Okay.
You know, and this is a guy who's really looking for a job. And Savannah's starting to question, you know, is he or isn't he who he says he is? You know, when paranoia seeps in at this stage of a plot, you know, that's, I think, about halfway through the book, you know, people start questioning each other and their families and themselves. You know, I think that I love to play with that element. I think that's really interesting and compelling.
Well, David wants to know if you could meet, where was that question? If you could meet one author, who would it be? But you've met them all.
Yeah, you know, I'd have to say there are a few that are dead
that, you know?
That I would love to meet. Dorothy Parker, you know, she's a writer. I would love to meet her. She seems like a lot of fun. So, yeah, no, I think that, you know, I've gotten to meet a lot of my favorite authors, and the biggest honor for me, this is my third Mary Higgins Clark Award nomination. And
oh,
Mary,
wow.
I'm so impressed by Mary, everything about her. You know, she was the first, that was the first adult novel I ever read. When I was a kid, I was in probably middle school, but I was like, I love books like this. I want to write books like this. And so to grow up and find yourself not just, you know, an author who writes these kind of books, and I actually was compared, you know, one of my first books was compared to her books. I feel like to have met her and then to have been nominated for this award a couple of times and know that, and she's read my stuff and enjoyed it and told me, you know, yeah, I that to me is beyond, you know, childhood dream coming true. It's pinched me. And even now, and she's a gracious, amazing, incredible woman. So, you know, I just have to say that, you know, I have met her, but she would have been, as a kid, she would have been it.
I would love to find out who works with her because I want to get some of her books.
Yeah.
I would love to get some of her books to review. It's not hard.
Right.
It's hard
yeah.
to get, you know, she's, I know who publishes her. I have to just find somebody at Simon & Schuster to tag.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so my next question is, and then David has one more. Truth, Lies, and Best Betrayals and Promises Never to Come, full circle. How did you manage to blend the past and the present and come up with such a great solid plot and an ending that no one's going to get? I'll tell you
no
that.
No, yeah, that was my blind side that I've been trying to pull off for many years. So I finally used it here. So, yeah, you know, to me, my editor and I talked about, and my agent, before I wrote this and conceived this trilogy about, you know, I write books about ordinary people who are in extraordinary circumstances. They're in the wrong place at the right time, but they're normal, everyday people that you can relate to. So how the heck do you write three books and make it believable that an ordinary person is going to, you know, find themselves in danger, or, you know, how are you going to link murder in three different books about ordinary people? We came up with setting for this one, and I thought, what about a town that was on the map because of murder? And I kind of had Lizzie Borden's Fall River, Massachusetts in mind, because that town, you know, when I was a kid, I was always obsessed with the Borden murders, and I, you know, I was like a starstruck person at the Borden, at the Fall River Historical Society. So I conceived this town as something like that. And I thought if it's known for murder, and if it's a town that seems to almost celebrate the crimes of the past, and they have this festival every summer, they call it Monday Palooza, where they invite people to solve these bloody murders. I thought that's a town that would draw, you know, believably it would draw more violence and people who are fascinated with macabre, you know, things. So that's where that all came from. I love the idea of past unsolved crimes being solved in the present and inspiring copycat, you know.
Well, if we have one more question that I can ask. She wants to know, what are three things besides writing that you love to do?
Three things. Well, I am a mom of two college boys, and I have a husband and my cat. So I love to I love to visit my boys at school. We just did that for Easter. They're both upstate. One's in Ithaca and one's in Geneseo. So I love to visit them and travel anywhere. I've done a 50-state book tour. I have one more state to visit. It's Wyoming. But, yeah, so travel and spending time with my boys. I love to have a crowd around my dining room table and feed them because I grew up in a huge family. I grew up upstate, and I'm Italian, and my mom was a great cook, and that's how I grew up. You know, it was blizzard country. It snowed a lot, and we sat around telling stories and eating a lot of food. So that's one of my favorite things to do. And I'm a swimmer. I swim laps because I have a terrible back. I have some back issues. So every day, as many days as I can, I take an hour out to go to the gym and I swim laps while reading books. So I found an underwater device that you can put audiobooks on. So I swim and read. So that kind of combines two of my favorite things. And that way I get my exercise
different.
And I read. Yeah. Yeah.
That's different, yeah.
Yeah.
I read wherever I go.
Yeah.
I found that I can't read on planes because it's too bumpy. But I read in the doctor's office. I read sitting outside in the building just outside on the benches.
Yep.
And I read waiting for my husband to get home from work. So I take a book downstairs while I'm waiting for him to show up. Because my mother
well,
made me read. I read 10 books a week.
Yeah, book lovers always have a book, right?
Yeah. My head is always somewhere in the book. I don't know where.
Yeah. Or
but
you have
it
with you waiting to pick it up. Any line, any place I ever am. I'm like, if I don't have a book, I feel lost.
I have like 25 inside that are staring at me. That would you please read me? I finished one this morning. That's probably where my eyes are strained. Once I get started, if a book is really good, I don't stop until I get it done, and that sometimes is not good. What can I say? Okay, I promised the people, there's a new store in Tarrytown, and I promised them that I would say something wonderful because they treated me like a rock star when I told them I was a radio host. Yeah, cool.
Wow.
Kirkland's in Tarrytown. It's at 419 Tarrytown Road. And the number is 914-428-1027. And I bought the coolest lamp there. I needed a new lamp for this room because I could see. And I got this beautiful standalone lamp. And all the people there, Christine and the manager and everybody, treated me as if I was very important. And it made me feel good. So I told them that I would definitely put that blog on my radio show and tell everybody to go. The store's gorgeous.
What is it? What kind of store? Is it home goods?
It's a home goods. It's like a home goods store. It's got lamps and tables and all sorts of stuff. It's absolutely fantastic. It's great. And Michelle just put you in touch with David.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
that's good.
You.
Yeah, he wants to do it. He wants us to be the new Regis and Kathy Lee, history just told me.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know.
that sounds fun. You guys will have a good time.
I don't know. If Aurora could speak, what would she say about the skull learning who it was? We're not going to say who it is. But,
right.
And what about Savannah? Will she take on the role of curator or will Sean? We didn't get to Sean.
Yeah, Sean is Rowan's nephew, and we can't say too much about him because his story plays out in Blood Red in the first book. His family's part in the story. So yeah, these are good questions. And Aurora is in her 80s, and she's not going to be there forever. So yeah, who's going to take over and have the same passion for the local historical society? I can't tell you, but you will find out in the end of the book. You will find out. And I almost felt like when I finished writing this story, this book, after 3 books and a few years in Mundy's Landing, at least in my head, I kind of didn't want to let it go. I mean, it was time, but I might need to come back here. We might need to revisit it in the future. So we'll keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. So before we end, what's next for you? And where can everybody find out about your work?
Yeah. Well, I'm on Facebook a lot. So Facebook is a good place to find me. I'm good with that. Lately, I've been traveling, and I have a hard time keeping up with social media when I am. And I'm going to be gone for a few weeks now. But, Facebook is always good. That's where you can find me. And also, I have a website that is about to be overhauled and updated thanks to the folks at Book Reporter. So I am... that'll be a really good place to find me again once it's overhauled. And you would ask what's next. I will say I just signed a new 3-book contract with HarperCollins for 3 books about – there's a central character. She's an investigative genealogist, and she helps to put foundlings in touch with their birth family. So that is, people who have been abandoned as infants. She's a foundling herself and has not been able to do that for herself, but that's her life's work. She tries to match, she tries to help them solve the mystery of her past. So there's 3 different books, and that will launch next spring from HarperCollins. And then in November, I did this Lilydale mystery series. It's set in the real-life town of Lilydale, and it's a town populated by spiritualists who can talk to the dead. And my heroine, these aren't paranormal, my heroine is a skeptic, and she's a single mom, a widow, and she is someone who comes into this town with her little boy and solves mysteries. So that book, Dead of Winter, that's the 3rd Lilydale title, that will be coming out in November.
Well, I hope I get it before everybody else.
Yeah, Crooked Lane, and we can talk about
that. I love
that,
working with HarperCollins. Who are you working with at HarperCollins?
That's Crooked Lane, and they're great too. That's Crooked Lane, and I can let the publicist know, and we can maybe have another date to talk about that book. And
that would be great, because I love working with HarperCollins. They are fantastic, and even if I have the wrong publicist, they find me the right one.
Oh, that's good.
Reason.
They are fantastic. Yes, yes.
Yeah, well,
great experience.
It's scary. I don't have to do anything. I just have to ask for it and get it. Okay, David has one last question before we go off the air. And
okay.
Where's my Facebook thing here? If my phone will. Which is the hardest book you ever had to write?
Wow, I will say.
That's a hard question. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good question, David. You know, it's not one of my Wendy Corsi style mystery and suspense novels. Mm-hmm. It's actually a book I wrote as Wendy Markham. It's called If Only My Dreams. And I was supposed to be writing something else. It was the summer I lost my mom mm-hmm. to breast cancer in 2005. And this book, it's about a woman who goes back in time to the 1940s. It's a romance. It's she falls in love with a war hero, and I get more reader mail for sure after all these years about that book. It was something that mm-hmm. I really wanted to write, and when my agent said it would never sell, because, and it was a really tough sell, but I sold it a few days mm-hmm. before Christmas. I felt like it was a gift from my mom saying, you were right to want to write this book. It's going to be a good book. And mm-hmm. the catch was that I had to have it written by the end of January, and it went back in time to the 40s. It's a time travel. Really upbeat. My film agent mm-hmm. has had, you know, there's a lot of interest in it, and it's something that I always feel like it's my favorite book, and it's the book that was the hardest to write because of my, you know, emotionally, I just kind of felt like I've got to do this for so many reasons, and I'm glad I did. So that's a good question.
Yeah, you know what? I know how that feels, because my mom had Alzheimer's, and I wrote her story afterwards.
Oh,
The Vanishing Mind of Ruth Swerdloff and Alzheimer's Sufferer's Journey. And I just felt that my family didn't really understand what she was going through. So
right.
I had a journal of her words, a real journal, and I copied her journal, and I got criticized a lot because I left the mistakes.
Oh,
I didn't
wow.
have the editor edit everything. I left her words. So basically, if I have typos or something, I really didn't care, because
no,
it was
that was her voice.
What my mother said, yeah, and a
yeah,
lot of people did.
What a gift.
So he asks one last question, then we're gonna go
yep.
off.
Yep.
Do you have a? Do you want to know if you have a big garden? I don't know where he got that from.
Do I have
okay.
a big garden?
Garden,
it's not very. Garden outside. I do love to garden, and it is not very big right now for sure, because I have been so consumed with work for the last, even the last couple of years. So, yeah, no. Nope.
So, it's a beautiful day outside.
Yep.
But unfortunately, it's going to rain on Thursday. So,
oh,
get yourself
thank you for
a pile
forecast.
Of books, people. get some books out. Get Born
yep.
White by Wendy, and seriously, and the best thing I could tell them is Mother's Day is May 14th, and
yep.
I expect people to get their aunt their presents, because I deserve them, because I do everything for everybody, and the best present in the world is a bunch of books in a basket with a couple of gift cards to Barnes & Noble and,
yeah.
and Amazon, and buy all the whole set of Wendy's books. And, you know, Father's Day, too, people like to read. And these are the
yep.
types of books that everyone's reading. And my husband said that he'll take it next because his hand is out for it. If he's nice, I'll give it to him, and maybe not.
That's nice. Tell him thank you. Yeah,
I don't give him away too fast. But
right.
thank you so much for today.
Oh, my
this
gosh.
Was, this was fun.
It was really fun. I think we'll just have to get together at Thriller Fest and chat some more because
I hope so. And I can't wait to meet you at the Thriller Fest. I'm going to be
yes.
there the 14th and the 15th and the 16th. I'm going to be there from the Friday to the Sunday. And
oh, great.
I'm so excited because I get to go to the panels and everything.
Oh, awesome. You'll enjoy it, and I will certainly be there for at least part of that in and out. So I'm looking forward to saying hello in person, and I really love to hear from my readers. So find me on Facebook, find me at www.wendycorsistab.com. That's my website. I promise it'll be all spanking new really soon.
Thank you so much, and I'm going to make
thank
this show public in about an hour so everybody could read
right.
it. The link
yep.
will be on my Facebook wall, and I'm going to email it to Cheryl so that she can send it to you.
Perfect. Thank
okay,
you
everybody.
So much, Fran. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Take care.
Bye.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.